Just a little bit of background, because, you know, on the face of it, it doesn't sound very much like a Easter story, does it? But some weeks, probably months ago now, I brought a sermon about earworms. It was about different people get hearing the wrong things in their ears, not godly things, but ungodly things. I mentioned about Peter, one fellow like Jonah as well. And just challenges us to think, you know, when we're hearing the wrong voices in our ears, and whether we actually take as much notice of them, or more notice of them rather, than what we should do, rather than hearing God's voice. And for this morning, I just want to bring to you a different part. You know, we have five senses. Ears and eyes, hearing and sight are two of them. And it's that sight that I want to think about this morning, and it comes into this reading greatly this morning about the use of eyes. As I read through it, I realised just how many times eyes are mentioned. It's probably about, you know, in one form or another, perhaps indirectly, in one form or another. That's about 8 times. I thought, I wonder what God's trying to say to us through this. As Mick mentioned, that's, you know, Samaria, Dothan. Samaria was part of Israel. It's the major part of Israel, actually, at one time. It came from two tribes that came from Joseph, the guy that, you know, the brother that got sold into slavery. And Samaria city, and that can be quite confusing sometimes. So Bob just says Samaria, and sometimes you have to work out what it means, the area or the city. The Samaria was the capital city of Israel at that time, before Jerusalem took that place with David. So that kind of lays that background up against it. But you've got this king of Aram. It's probably a man called Ben-Hadad. And he was raiding the area around Samaria and causing them a lot of problems. And he was setting up raiding parties to go in. And he may have been alongside him, we don't know. Sounds like he probably was. But every time he set up these raiding parties, somehow the then king of Israel seemed to know about it. And it was really frustrating Ben-Hadad, and he wanted to do something about it. So he called all his men together and said, well, look, you know, as we all do, we try to blame somebody, don't we? When something goes wrong, we try to blame them or find that somebody to blame. We don't want to blame ourselves through mistakes we've made. We always want to blame somebody else. And he was doing the same thing. He called his leaders together and said, okay, who is it? Who's telling them? Not me, Gov. Whoa, not me. They were dead scared of the king. They didn't want his, you know, reprobation on them. So they did the best that they could to try and persuade the Syrian king, as he would have been, that it was nothing to do with them. They said, but we think we know who it is. And this is guy Elisha. Well, who's he? He's a prophet. Right, okay. So where is he? Do you know where he's living? Yeah, and his place called Dothan. Right, go and get him. I want him here. I do not want him passing on this news to the king anymore. And they say, well, he seems to know what you're doing, even in your room. But no, he seems to know what's going on. He seems to hear or see what you're planning beforehand. So yeah, it's probably a good thing to do. We'll go and get him for you. So they send off. The king sends off this large, and it has to be a large army to Dothan. And when I was thinking about this, Dothan is quite a large city, even in those days. It was a city of some 6,000 people. Doesn't sound large nowadays, but in those days it was. It was about 6,000 people. So it was quite a major city. So it had to be a large contingent of soldiers that had to go to surround it, which is what they would normally do. And I started to think about, you know, the news recently, you know, on television about the steelworks in Ukraine and how Putin has decided to not to swamp it with his troops, but surround it. So, as he said, a fly couldn't get in. News tells us at the moment, perhaps he's changed his mind yet again. But perhaps that's what this troop had in mind, to surround Dothan, whether to attack it or just to bring it to its knees. So they gave up Elisha. We don't know. But that's what they did. They surrounded it. But then comes in this servant of Elisha. That in itself can be a little bit confusing, because there are two servants of Elisha. There's one that's named called Gehazi. He'd blown it some while ago. He'd been with Elisha for a long time. He'd seen lots of the miracles that Elisha had done. And as he got kind of more comfortable in the relationship with Elisha, he started to think, well, perhaps we should be getting some material benefit from this, something that Elisha had never done. He never demanded money. People would give it to him, perhaps, and he might accept it. He never demanded it before he did the miracles. And there were some very notable miracles. But Gehazi decided that when Naaman had been healed of his leprosy, that Gehazi would chase after Naaman and demand, almost in Elisha's name, some payment for it. When Elisha found out about this, he was very disgruntled about it. And the very leprosy that had been a problem for Naaman was put on Gehazi for the rest of his life and on his family. Sounds quite harsh, doesn't it, really? But that's how God works in it. Because God doesn't want something that he has done to be costly to people. So now you've got this new servant who's going along with Elisha. He hasn't seen all these miracles. He doesn't know what to expect. He's just there probably to get Elisha's food and water and to make sure he's okay, get his clothes ready and things like that. A bit like a manservant, really, more than anything. But he hasn't seen all these miracles. And he's in Dothan. He wakes up early and wants to start his duties, goes outside for whatever reason, just looks around, and he sees this army. There's a lady in Ukraine who said, she was interviewed and she said she'd been in some of the catacombs kind of thing, the tunnels underneath this big steelworks. She said, I haven't seen daylight for 2 months. Imagine what it's going to be like if she came out now and saw Putin's army around her. And that's how Elisha's servant felt. He looked and he was scared. Who would not be? And he goes running into Elisha and says, have you seen what's happened out here? This massive army, we're lost. We've had it. The whole city's going to go. They're going to crush us. But Elisha comes out and just says, he understands how he feels. And Elisha says, Lord, open up his eyes. And he does. And he suddenly sees this army, this heavenly army that's far outnumbers anything that man could put up against that city. And Elisha says, those that are for us are more than those that are against us. I don't think it's recorded. I can't remember being recording what Mick was saying, that what the servant's response to that was. But I know what my response would be, and that'd be, I'd be awestruck. You know, be absolutely amazing to know that that was going to happen. And you think that'd be enough, wouldn't you, really? You think that, you know, heaven's armies against this very human army would be enough, but it's not. Elisha's got other plans, like plans that God has put in his head on that point. Elisha knows God so well that he knows the mind of God in that way. So Elisha says, well, look, Lord, will you blind the eyes of these men? Blind the eyes of the army. God hears him, he blinds them. And I thought, I wonder if it's the kind of blindness that we might think where, you know, you've gone totally blind, where you have to use a white stick. I'm not too sure it's like that, because we hear a little later on that Elisha led them back away from Dothan. So I'm guessing it's more like a blindness of the mind as much as anything. They just didn't realise where they were. He kind of, for want of a better word, fooled them into thinking they were in completely the wrong place. And he led them away. He led them to the city or the region of Samaria, but also the city of Samaria. Samaria was a big city. It was the capital city at that time before Jerusalem took over from them. We know Jesus in the Gospels, it talks about, you know, the Samaritans not being the nicest people, and, you know, the Jews wouldn't even associate with them. But Jesus actually used them to show, use Samaritans in the story of the Good Samaritan, to show the Jews that there can be good works in lots of people. But it's to this city, Samaria, the city of Samaria, that Elisha led this army to. Can you imagine the reaction as they walked into that city, the walled city, with the gates, as the Bible always says, with gates and iron bars? That means it was well fortified. They walked into that, not even knowing what they were walking into. And then Elisha says, "Lord, open their eyes." And they are. Imagine the reaction. You imagine the reaction of Putin soldiers around that steelworks, and they were suddenly surrounded and trapped in by some sort of European, oh no, it's not going to happen, some sort of European army around that's vastly outnumbers them again. What's their reaction going to be? They're just terrified. Because they probably know where they were the people who thought they were going to win the battle. Now they're the ones who are in danger now. And that's what happened to this army. As big as it may be, it was in the middle of Samaria. The normal thing that would happen when the king of incumbent king in Samaria saw them in there, the normal thing that he would have done would have slaughtered them there and then. There were no two thoughts about it. They were the enemy. They've been raiding his country. They caused him loads and loads of trouble. We'll do away with them now. At least that will get rid of a lot of them anyway. But Elisha says, no, there's another way. Don't slaughter them. Feed them. Look after them. Treat them well. That must have been a wow moment for the king. Something he completely did not expect. But he listened to Elisha. He treated them well. I think maybe say that he rehorsed them or did something, gave them supplies to go back home and allowed them to leave. And that made a huge, great difference. And they stopped raiding the country. I've got to say, it was slightly more short-lived because eventually they did come and raid the country and took it over completely. But in that instance, it stopped all the raids and there was peace for some while. I can probably hear you saying, what's that got to do with Easter? We expected an Easter story this morning. We expected about, you know, him, what happened to the disciples after Jesus had been resurrected. He had appeared to them in that time between when he was taken back up into heaven again. We expected that. But just as with the Easter story, God's at the center of this story. From Elisha supernaturally knowing the invading king's plan, to opening the servant's eyes to a heavenly army, to striking the invading force with blindness, or at least to what was happening to them, if not the actual blindness. To open the eyes of unexpected deliverance amidst their enemy, an act of uncompromising compassion. The end result was peace. Does that now strike a bell? In that Easter story, come back to that and relating the two, there were terrified eyes. The terrified eyes of Elisha's servant. And the followers of Jesus feeling lost and afraid without the leader to guide them anymore, just waiting for the unexpected knock on the door and subsequent rest, and then who knows, suffer the death that Jesus suffered as well, beheaded, thrown to lions, whatever. They were shocked eyes. How could this happen? What's going to happen now? We thought we knew. But now this? Didn't expect this. Opened eyes, but uncertainty. They might have thought, what's expected of us now? We know the truth, but what do we do with it? We want Jesus to guide us. What do we do? We feel lost. Challenged eyes. The master had the same heritage as us, and the Jews still wouldn't believe him. Why should they listen to us? All thoughts that perhaps are going through their heads in the room when they're hiding away from the rest of the Jews that didn't believe, to compassionate eyes. I wonder if they remembered the words that Jesus spoke. I wonder if Peter remembered the words that Jesus spoke to him on the beach. Words to bring him back to the place where Jesus knew he should be. To Mary in the garden. Don't be afraid, Mary. And she realized he was the one that she knew so well. The rest of the disciples, when they remembered how he cooked for them on the beach. Thomas, how he put his fingers in his hands. The compassion that Jesus showed to them. So how do you fit into these two stories? Which pair of lenses are you looking through today? What sets of eyes are you looking through today? Eyes are like lenses. Not a lot different really to camera lenses. Does the situation you're in seem to be frightening, insurmountable, impossible, as it did to Elisha's servant and the disciples? Or are they open to God's glory and support and compassion? Just wanted to show you, as long as technology works, some pictures of a young lady. First, this picture is one you know that I've taken Harrison out on trips using cameras, using lenses. And I said to him, look for things that are out of the usual. I never expected him to come up with a photograph like this. He took it through a beer bottle that he found on a beach. Not something I would recommend to him anymore, but he'd done it without me noticing. He just presented the photograph to me, and I thought it was amazing. I said to him to look for the unusual. It's very easy to take family photographs and things like that. That's nice, but when you're out doing this sort of photography, it's nice to look for the unusual. And I never expected him to take a photograph like this, and it inspired me. And this also inspired me. It's a young girl called Catherine Pugh. She's Welsh. What's in her name? Pugh. But this is her. She was 23. She was working in a French ski resort. And she was going back to wherever they were living on a coach. And the coach crashed. That's her on the left in hospital, just a little while later. She'd gone from that first photograph to being close to death. And this is the coach that crashed. It caught fire, as you can see. Everybody else thought they got out, including her boyfriend, thought everybody was out. Then he suddenly had a look around and he couldn't find his girlfriend, realised she was still on board. So he rushed back into the flames, grabbed hold of her, but not to put too fine a point, she was already quite well alight. But he dragged that out, and his heroism in that saved her life. Now, top left-hand picture is Catherine Hospital. You can see that despite the smile, she had extensive burns over her body. 95% of her body was covered in burns. There was not enough skin left to do plastic surgery. Only the soles of her feet escaped the flames. It was that bad for her. On the picture slightly over to the right there, that's her. After she came out of hospital, after months, she's been put in an induced coma for several months, I think 3 months, while the operation, or the first operations took place, and obviously there have been subsequent ones. You can see some of the scarring still here, and it's actually quite prevalent over the rest of her body as well. She had so much scarring around her body that there was nowhere that they could take skin grafts from. So she actually had her family, gave her mum and her brother, gave skin grafts to her. So she laughs about it now, which says, I've got my brother on my arm and my mum on my tummy. These pictures all come from a program that Jack and I watched. I think David might have been there as well. It's called Extraordinary Portraits. And each week, they take a different subject. This particular one happened to be about Catherine, but it could be many others that are chosen for whatever reason. And they take an artist, not always the same artist, and they work and they do a drawing of them or a painting of them, or however they do, it might be a sculpture of them. For Catherine, they chose this man, one with a beard. His name's Kelvin. He's a photorealistic drawer. He just uses pencils. You can see just in that center picture as he's starting one of something different, of another portrait. And this isn't a black and white photograph of John Lennon. It's one of his drawings. They are that photorealistic. So he's a major talent for doing this sort of work. And they asked him if he would do a photorealistic drawing of Catherine. What he did, he spent time with the family. You see mum and brother to the left of that, Catherine to the right, and her father just in the background slightly there. One or two other photographs. But what Kelvin did, he walked with Catherine and got to know her. He took her, walked with her to different places where her dad had taken her in her wheelchair during her recovery over all those years. And he got to know her. He spoke to her. He went to all the places that she loved to go. As part of this drawing, this new portrait of this extraordinary portraits program's called, he took multiple photographs of her in the places where she wanted to be. And as he took those photographs, he started to see, as he interacted with her, the real person behind those scars, the real Catherine that was there. It had come out a lot in the talking to her family anyway. It came out in the talking to her early, but as he spent more and more time with her, then a bigger picture, the picture he wanted to show, came out. Catherine knew what he was going to do. She was part of the program, but she'd said to him, I don't want my scars to be hidden. I don't want them to be airbrushed out. They're part of me. You have these photographs. There's Catherine in the middle. That's the drawing that he did of her. You can see how photorealistic it is. It's not a photograph. It is a drawing. Most of his drawings take 150 to 300 hours to do. Hers took 600 hours. He started off with this blank to the right, top right there, and then filled in the detail afterwards. It's a brave thing to do, but that's what Catherine wanted. This is Catherine. More recently, you can see looking totally different. The scars are still there. They've not gone. But now she's become a model. She doesn't mind the photograph being taken. She doesn't hide her scars in any way, shape, or form. This is her. She went to university. She got a degree now in physiotherapy, and she now helps others who have gone through the same trauma as she had of burns or other injuries. In the right-hand picture, you see her. You can see the scarring on her. She's not trying to hide it. But look at that smile. The young woman next to her is Katie Piper. Hope I got it right. Katie Piper. She also was a victim of burns. And she had acid thrown over her face by somebody employed by a boyfriend. And she spent months and months. And she has started the Katie Piper Foundation to help victims such as her, such as Katrin, and others. And that's a new way of looking at things. It's a new perspective, isn't it, of looking at things. Now, I can't claim that Katrin has become a Christian, but I do know that Katie Piper has. And then I do know that Jesus met with her on her bed in the hospital when she was going through all the work on the scarring, etc. These pictures inspired me. Watching the program inspired me. As Harrison inspired me with this picture. I now look for pictures like that instead of looking for the things that perhaps I was encouraging him to look at. Just something different. And I wonder how that might affect us in our Christian walk, just as it affected Elisha and his servant, just as looking through a different lens, a new lens, perhaps affected the disciples, and looking through a different lens affected Katrin and Katie. These inspired me, and I hope that they inspire you. If you'd like to watch the program in its fullness, then it is available on iPlayer, because it's amazing. Extraordinary Portraits on iPlayer. At Katrin Pugh, if you want to look it up. Might be time now just to pray and just to offer our thoughts to the Lord by seeing these images.